This is The State of Things. I'm Melinda Pencava. In a new novel, a young white taxi driver robs his white passengers if he doesn't like what they say about blacks, and eventually he does it just for them being white. The novel is called Angry Black White Boy, and like the title character, author Adam Mansbach is a white boy from the Boston suburbs who became interested in hip-hop music as a teen. Mansbach's book focuses on race from the perspective of a white boy angry at whites. Adam Mansbach joins us in the studio now. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
Well, you have said that in writing this novel, you were interested in getting at notions of hip-hop literature.
Mm-hmm.
So what is it that makes a novel or any kind of literary work a hip-hop, which is musical by nature?
Well, in its broadest application, hip-hop is a culture before it's a music. And it involves such artistic vectors as hip-hop music, but also breakdancing or b-boying, graffiti art, and a whole set of cultural practices. And when I think of hip-hop literature, which is, by the way, a term that's being bandied about very freely right now because the industry has figured out you can use it to sell everything from soda to cars to books. So everything that spells fat with a PH is now being called hip-hop literature. And I'm kind of interested in being rigorous about applying that term before the term becomes meaningless. Mm-hmm. So to me, a hip-hop literature should reflect the kind of dexterity and democracy and open-mindedness that characterized, for instance, the early hip-hop DJs like Grandmaster Flash, who at a hip-hop party, before hip-hop itself was on vinyl, would play everything from rock to jazz to funk to soca to TV commercials. You know, they'd play 4 seconds of the Monkees if there was a nice drum break on it.
Mm-hmm.
So I want a hip-hop literature to reflect that principle in terms of borrowing from and collaging inventively from a wide array of influences, sources, ideas, writers, styles. I also think a hip-hop literature should try to create dialogue and community on behalf of people who have traditionally been marginalized,
mm-hmm.
the way that these same DJs did by throwing parties in the parks after the rec centers in the Bronx had been shut down. And I also wanted to have the kind of premium on innovation linguistically that rap has always had, and I wanted to be as audacious in taking back public space as the graffiti writers were who started writing on trains in the 70s in New York City.
Well, this sort of confuses my next question, which was going to be, is it form or is it content? And it sounds
right.
Like it's both.
I think, yeah, it's both. I mean, with this book, somebody said that Public Enemy's album, It Takes a Nation of Millions to Hold Us Back, was the first rap album to use all 48 tracks on a 48-track board. And I like that idea because it implies that if you sort of drop out certain elements, then other elements come to the forefront. So, for instance, if you dropped out the plot and the character, you would be left with sort of a graph along that board of all the samples or references that I'm making. And like hip-hop, you maybe would understand the book on one level if you knew what the reference points were and another if you didn't. And that, you know, can go either way. I mean, if you don't know who Diana Ross is, you might think Puff Daddy is a genius.
Because he uses samples of Diana Ross?
Right.
Okay.
Now, if you do know who Diana Ross is, you might downgrade him from a genius to a sloppy thief, you know? Hopefully, my book, it'll work the other way around. Like, if you know the references that I'm dealing with and the framework, then you'll enjoy the book on another level, a higher level.
Well, I was hoping maybe you could give us a sample from what you've written here that gets at some of this.
Sure. This is a short little paragraph from early on in the book. And this is describing my main character, Macon Detournay's experiences in the house that he lived in after graduating high school, but before moving on to college.
And Macon, we should say, is the angry black white boy.
Yeah, he is the title character. Macon had learned the most from Jihad, the big entrance-making, uninvited drop-in neighbor the audience loved. A Newport-smoking, monologue-spitting herbologist with matching Nikes for every rugby shirt he owned, and a penchant for talking the esoteric God-body science of the five percenters from one mouth corner, and hustle-ego-watch-me as unfiltered as New York tap water out the other. Macon's star vehicle spinoff, Katz joked, would be a show called Adopted Brother. They plotted episodes in the perennial back-alley twilight that slashed in sideways from the street lamp and gave the dust something to dance in besides the glow of the forever-on TV.
Adam Mansbach reading from his new novel, Angry Black White Boy. So this character, Macon Everett Detournay, he's a taxicab driver.
Yes.
Is that right? And among the things he does as a taxi cab driver is he holds up white people. He is white. He holds up white passengers who he feels are speaking disparagingly of blacks.
Well, that's almost incidental, because Macon has developed such a profound critique of whiteness that the complacency and the arrogance of white people in general tends to offend him. So the first time that he commits one of these robberies, there is kind of a trigger, so to speak. Two triggers, really. One that he's holding, but the trigger in this case is a vaguely disparaging comment. But he then goes on a rampage and robs about 20 other people. And it's really not so much for any actions they commit in his cab as much as it is simply because they are white, and their whiteness and the hypocrisy inherent to it offends Macon. And he actually doesn't get caught right away because people cannot put his words together with his face. He's perfectly visible in this cab as he's robbing people, but because he's calling them white devils and giving them little tirades, the word goes out that it is a black cab driver, some kind of crazy, radical, militant nut job who's robbing white people for the crime of being white. And thus Macon's crime spree goes on for about 2 weeks.
And that has to incense him even more.
Well, it does when he realizes it. At first, he's not even aware of it. He sort of chalks it up to the craziness of New York City, where he's just moved to go to college. But when he does finally realize it and realizes that the effects of this crime spree are putting black cab drivers out of work, among other things, also preventing white people from taking cabs so black people can finally get cabs. It's, you know, white people are carpooling to work. It's kind of like the Montgomery bus boycott on acid. But when Macon eventually figures out what's going on, he sort of turns himself in.
So how did you come up with a character like Macon?
To me, Macon is symbolic of a generation of white kids whose investment in hip-hop culture is profound enough that they represent a moment of potential in terms of transforming and elevating the dialogue on race in this country. But there are also a lot of pitfalls. There's a certain kind of self-indulgence and narcissism that can come with that crossover, and there's sort of an inherent disconnect because a lot of these kids seem to think that the opposite of white privilege is blackness, which it's not. The opposite of white privilege is dismantling white privilege. So I wanted to explore the notion of the down white boy, the white kid who's invested in hip-hop, invested in some sense in a critique subconsciously or consciously of whiteness and of the white community from which he comes, and what this particular moment and this crossroads looks like. I wanted to do that through the vehicle of Macon and through the vehicle of satire.
How much of yourself is in this?
Macon and I share a lot of geographical and cultural history. We're both from the suburbs of Boston. We both got into hip-hop at a particular time when hip-hop was, unlike today, very rooted in resistance and political consciousness and a certain kind of Afrocentric orientation. We diverged, certainly, before Macon starts robbing people.
You haven't done that.
No, I haven't done that. I write books instead. But I share with Macon a lot of history in terms of being the anomalous white kid in the hip-hop community in the late 80s. There weren't that many of us back then, and being a member of that community made you sort of ultra-aware of your whiteness. And there was the paradox of being hyper-aware but also sort of trying to escape it, looking for a certain kind of absolution, looking for acceptance and gratification from black people in the hip-hop community. And, you know, it's a very sort of complex and interesting pathology that I wanted to unpack. And I wanted to be as brutally honest about this stuff as I could, because I feel like that's the way into this discussion, is to put whiteness on the table in a way that it's not in mainstream discourse. So I drew a lot from my own experiences in doing that in terms of creating Macon's backstory. But the plot itself and what happens with Macon is pretty out of control, and, you know, most of that has not happened to me in real life.
So when you were a teenager, I guess it was like the late 80s, when you were really attaching yourself to hip-hop culture, you were the rare white kid that you knew that was doing that. Hip-hop has become much more mainstream.
Right.
I mean, you have a lot more white kids who are drawn to
Absolutely.
It. Eminem
sure.
comes to mind, too.
Sure.
So is that better, or does that come with some baggage, too?
I think it's a mixed blessing, certainly. I mean, the legacy of co-option and exploitation of black culture by white people is so profound in this country that we need to look at it critically right off top. And I guess I'm a little bit disturbed by the younger generation of white hip-hop fans because they simply have grown up at a time in a cultural moment when questions of ownership were not so crucial. They grew up in the mainstream era. And this current crop of kids has no reason to be gaining this new awareness of race and questioning whiteness and being objective about whiteness's subjectivity, because no one has ever implied or told them that hip-hop is not for them or that they need to be careful in what cultural spaces they tread. There's no lived experience inherent to participation in hip-hop anymore. When I was young, hip-hop didn't live in the suburbs. It wasn't on the radio. So you had to physically take your behind to where it was, which was in the city. It was urban. It was culturally based in record stores and radio shows that were inaccessible to you if you didn't go there. And those experiences, you know, were largely eye-opening for me. And to take it back and historicize it, you know, you take the example of sort of the proto-jazz fan, the white jazz fan in the 40s. You had to go up to Minton's and sit down and listen to jazz, and you were going to meet people along the way. Now the mediation of technology is so profound, you never actually have to leave your comfort zone to consume and experience hip-hop. You can, in fact, pick up your Xbox and play the Streets of New York video game and be Busta Rhymes and break a Hennessy bottle over somebody's head in front of a bodega in what is being marketed as a manifestation of legitimate hip-hop culture. And also the culture itself has become so distorted by materialism, misogyny, that it's in many ways depressing and would not lead kids, white or black, to the kind of eye-opening experiences and lead them to read the kind of books that it led me to read when I was that age. Back then, to understand hip-hop, you had to find out what Chuck D and KRS-One were talking about by reading Malcolm X, reading Eldridge Cleaver, reading Bobby Seale, reading about the Black Panthers. Now, if you were to explore hip-hop in a parallel way, you would have to go to Jacob the Jewelers or go to, like, the Lexus dealership.
We're talking with Adam Mansbach, author of Angry Black White Boy. Support for the State of Things comes from listeners who support North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC. This is the State of Things. I'm Melinda Pencava, and we're talking with Adam Mansbach, author of the new satire, Angry Black White Boy. He calls it a satire, and it follows the exploits of a white college student and taxi driver who robs white passengers to avenge what he sees as white privilege. So you have your character here, Macon de Tournay, and he gets, the thing that flips the switch for him is when he's very young and he's living in L.A., and the Rodney King jury comes back. The cops that beat Rodney King were not guilty.
Right.
And he has a decision. He wants to go out and do something about it.
Yeah, that's kind of a watershed moment for Macon, because it's sort of the sharpest slap that justice has taken in his lifetime. And it's televised and it's inescapable. And the horror of it is so immediate to him, despite the fact that he's geographically, economically, racially, 3,000 miles away. He's actually in Newton, Massachusetts when the verdict comes out. Nonetheless, he feels as if he's at ground zero. And this becomes a very politicizing moment for him. It's the moment in which he stops sort of investing any belief in the justice of the system. And it kind of radicalizes him.
And he decides he wants to go out and have his own riot.
Yeah, he sort of tries to set off a one-man riot and burns a cop car. The paradox is that despite his energy and despite this riot that he's so insistent on creating, there's no energy for that to bump off of. He's stuck in the suburbs, so he sets his cop car on fire and it just burns to the ground and nothing happens. And he's sort of left there amidst the ashes, still alone.
There's a passage in your book that I was hoping you might read for us where he shows up at a hip-hop conference and he's wearing a Malcolm X shirt. Did this happen to you?
Oh, yeah. This is one of those moments where Macon is sort of standing in for me. And, you know, in retrospect, why was I the 13-year-old white kid wearing the Malcolm X shirt at the hip-hop conference? Well, very simply, it's because I wanted to be approached and asked what I knew about Malcolm, why I was wearing that shirt. And my response was like, you know, thank you for asking. I will now run down for you a litany of facts about Malcolm's life. And when I finish, you will be so impressed that you will give me a pound, a handshake, tell me that I'm the downest white boy around, and I'm cool, and I'm all right, and you'll usher me into your good graces. And I'll be like, thank you. And then I'll move further into the room and have the exact same conversation with somebody else and somebody else and somebody else. It's this kind of serial desire for absolution and acceptance. And I think what underwrites it is a vague notion for me, for Macon, for white kids in general who go through this series of practices, that whiteness is not okay. There's something there that is to be critiqued. There's some history that we should feel guilty about or feel conflicted about or feel uneasy about. There is some awareness, as dim as it might be, that things are not okay. So this cultural move away from whiteness and this look to black folks for acceptance, I think, is the beginning of a stirring of consciousness about those things.
Mm-hmm. Well, can you read us the passage there?
Sure. From Macon's confusion had bubbled anger. How dare black people not see him as an ally, not recognize that he was down? He retaliated by studying their history, their culture. He was a 13-year-old white boy in a Malcolm X t-shirt, alone at the first annual Boston hip-hop conference, heart fluttering with intimidation and delight as scowling, bald-headed old-schoolers pointed at his chest, demanding, "What you know about that man?" Which was exactly what he'd wanted, why he'd worn it. He ran down Malcolm's life for them, watched them revise their expressions with inward elation, nodded studiously at their government assassination theories, rhymed when the chance presented itself, tagged other graffiti writers' black books, and wondered what it would take to be scratched from the devil list for good.
Adam Mansbach, reading from his new novel, Angry Black White Boy. Well, Macon Detournay is the main character here, empathizing with black culture, embracing it, but you don't hold him up as some paragon. He has his faults. I wonder if some of them might be about that crossing of the color line, at least maybe his motivations for doing so.
In a lot of ways, the book is almost a handbook on what not to do in terms of forwarding this dialogue on white privilege and race. Macon is very committed to pushing white people, to forcing them to confront their own whiteness, their own culpability, but he's also very twisted up and his personal identity is very much in question. He's a 19-year-old kid who has fame sort of thrust upon him in the course of this book, and he fails. His understanding of race is very deep but very narrow. He's constantly looking for absolution and validation for who he is. He's got a real resistance to forging alliances with older generations who are invested in the same goals as him. He's kind of running this whole movement that develops around him on the fly without thinking anything out. And in some ways, that's a parallel to the kind of leadership that emerged out of the hip-hop generation, you know, out of a vacuum in leadership in the 80s, post-civil rights, post-black power, post-COINTELPRO, post-Reaganomics, post-crack. Rappers were kind of thrust into these roles as leaders, people like KRS-One, Chuck D, Ice Cube, and they were very sincere and very impassioned, but didn't have a lot of institutional training. They didn't know how to really lay the groundwork for a foundation. So it was this very galvanizing moment, and in a lot of ways, that moment in hip-hop has given us a new language with which to discuss activism. There's this whole notion of hip-hop activism. But organizationally, it was not very successful. It was tied to market forces that swung the other way. And Macon is kind of coming out of all of that. So when he gets put in this position of power after he is arrested for these robberies, captures the media's imagination, sort of knows how to spin that media, and ends up calling for a national day of apology, based on Malcolm X's statement that white people should just walk up to blacks on the street and apologize, which for Malcolm was a rhetorical statement. Macon is like, we're going to do it Friday. And people sort of stream into New York City from all over the country to participate in this sort of ill-considered, well-intentioned, and ultimately disastrous day of apology. He is not really thinking more than 5 minutes ahead at any time. He knows that he needs to act. He's caught up in a kind of desire to do something, because doing anything is better than doing nothing. He's so fed up with the lack of dialogue, the stagnation, that he's ready to act and just sort of see what the consequences are.
Well, Adam Mansbach, you mentioned a moment ago that what you're after here is writing things that were brutally honest.
Mm-hmm.
What would you think is the most brutally honest thing you wrote here that would take people by surprise?
That's an interesting question. I don't know whether I can pinpoint one specific sentiment. I think the whole notion of writing an internal monologue that is so fundamentally focused on race is the thing that's been shocking to some people. People have been telling me, you know, writing to me, readers and so forth, saying it's amazing to read a character who is so inescapably gnarled up in this one issue, who's so painfully self-aware about these things. I think in some ways maybe that's revelatory or surprising or shocking to some people. On the other hand, I've had a ton of people writing me to say, these are the kinds of thoughts I think, and I've never been able to express them or talk about them publicly, and I'm gratified to see it on paper. And also people saying, I've never thought about this stuff, but after reading this character, you know, I'm thinking about these things through a whole new lens.
Does a day ever go by when you don't think about race?
Not on this book tour.
Okay.
Well, you know, I mean, right now I'm caught up in doing a lot of public speaking and thinking about it. But my commitment is actually not to let a day go by, because I think ultimately the problem is that white people can stop thinking about race whenever we feel like it, because our race is seen as normative, and that's not true for anybody else in this country. So I think the first step toward changing things and getting this kind of conversation started and sustained is for white people to see that whiteness is an identity, that white privilege is operating in ways seen and unseen every moment of our lives. We are riding with the wind to our backs, and everybody else is riding into the wind. And it's very easy not to be aware of that. And it's very problematic and dangerous and destructive not to be aware of that. So I really am trying to think about it mm-hmm. every day.
For a while, you were an MC in Boston?
Yeah, I'm still an MC, actually. I go by the name Kodiak Brinks as an MC, and I actually just released an album called Stand for Nothing, Fall for Anything, which is a live hip-hop album featuring me on the mic and a six-piece band.
So you've been rapping for a long time?
Yeah, since I was about 11. Mm-hmm. Pretty much as soon as I discovered hip-hop, I started rapping. I was always kind of a kid who was interested in words.
How are you being received with this work, both with your hip-hop work and with hip-hop literature?
My commitment, I think, is very clearly to put the issue of white privilege on the table. And what I've been seeing so far in my public appearances and through the people contacting me is that there is a real appetite for this conversation, and people just need a way in. There is an investment in talking about these things. We just have lost the language to do so and the forums to do so. You know, that wasn't the case 50 years ago. I mean, when James Baldwin published The Fire Next Time, it was in The New Yorker. I mean, this was in like a mainstream magazine. Imagine the equivalent to The New Yorker or the Saturday Evening Post or Life magazine, all of which were publishing these kinds of in-depth, provocative, soul-searching essays. Imagine People magazine, which is probably the closest equivalent in terms of circulation today, putting aside its coverage of, you know, desperate housewives to publish a 90-page essay on race in America. I mean, we just don't have forums anymore. So I've been received with a lot of positivity, really. And I'm speaking at colleges, I'm speaking in bookstores, I'm doing high schools, and everywhere I've gone, I've been really encouraged by the dialogue. It often ends up being that the only thing that cuts the dialogue off is the fact that the bookstore has to turn the lights off or the college class gets dismissed, which leads to the next question, which is, after you jumpstart this dialogue, how do you sustain it? How do you ensure that it is continuous instead of something that happens one night, gives people some things to think about, but then is really never brought up again? That's, to me, the second challenge.
Adam Mansbach, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.